That's the question that certainly I'm thinking about recently. And let me tell you a little bit of background. There was a call for GI proposals, for tests recently. And so started some discussions on that actually way back last fall, because that was supposed to be the time that proposals were going in, but as you know, they were delayed. Basically it was a proposal that said, okay, what kind of science would we in the Stellar group for ZTF want to do with tests? Okay, so that was the proposal. That proposal went in. With that proposal, however, was a thought is that we were going to be using ZTF for helping us do our science with tests. And we put that into the proposal and said, okay, we're going to be doing this. We'll be willing to share that data that we have with anyone. Okay? And let me tell you a little bit about ZTF. So ZTF is set up to be 40% what we call MSIP, it's NSF funded, 40% partnership funded, and so that's a whole bunch of different institutions. We can get into that. And then 20% Caltech a ton. Okay. And so the thing that I could control via NASA proposal was, I thought I could, I knew I could get, because I arranged it, get half the Caltech time, which is about 10% of the ZTF time, okay? And that would be something that I could make happen. I could make that public. I also had all the machinery to take the data from that and make that data public. So that's how things started. It was a NASA proposal to do science with tests, Stellar science, but then included with that is saying, okay, well, we can take 10% of the ZTF time and make it public. And so our proposal then, in that NASA proposal, was to essentially do cover the test footprint every night in GNR with 12-second exposures. Now, some of you may know, and I'll get into it, that ZTF normally does 30-second exposures. But both to be able to fit within half the Caltech time, and also to match up better in terms of sensitivity, saturation, precision with tests, 12 seconds made a lot of sense. Okay, so that's the baseline that we started from. Cover the test field of view every night, the entire 24 by 96 field of view. It takes roughly about 50 ZTF points. Do that in G and in R band, okay? And do it at 12 seconds exposure rather than 30 seconds exposure. So that's how things started. So we discussed this a bit at Caltech and with the partnership. There was a wide range of opinions depending on what type of science you were from and what type of science might not benefit from this. Jim knows this. Jim and my group meet typically on Thursdays together, so we have lots of discussions. But in general, from the test side of things, talked to lots of test people, they were enthused about this because of the ZTF pixel size primarily. Okay, so ZTF pixel size is 1 arc second compared to the test's 21 arc second pixels. Okay, so people like Andrew Howard at Caltech, who I was surprised about this, does exoplanets, was very enthusiastic about doing ZTF coverage because one could see what objects were varying within the test pixel. I was particularly interested in it because in denser regions, like near the galactic plane, you just can't do much with 21 arc second pixels when that's the 50% energy enclosure. So it's actually larger than that, right, as the actual effective point spread function. So having ZTF would allow us then to work in the galactic plane, stellar, much better. Okay, so that's how things started. Okay, and the proposal went in. There's been a peer review, I understand. Some of you may have been on the peer review. But what started to happen then after people saw the proposal that I and the Stellar team at Caltech put in is they started really getting very much more interested in things. And so now what's on the table is that even more time, roughly, let's say, another 20% of the ZTF time could be put towards test complementary observations. So effectively, something like between 25 to 30% of the ZTF time could be put behind this. And where does that come from? That would come from then the NSF survey part of the ZTF time. Okay, so we take part of the MSIP, what we call MSIP, NSF funded time, and put it actually to covering the test field of view. So the question then to all of you is, what's the best way to do that? And what I'm going to do is very quickly go through so that everybody's on the same page about ZTF, okay, and say a few things about ZTF and test complementarity, and then it's discussion after that. You know, yeah.
Just a quick clarification question. You may say the coverage is 1G and 1R over the entire test field.
That was the NASA proposal.
That's the original NASA.
Right. That was the original NASA proposal. but you know, we're thinking lots of different options now. Okay, so this group. Give me your ideas, okay? Because we have now, with this other perhaps 15-20% of the ZTF time, lots of flexibility to mix and match, right? So the 10% Caltech time is still there. We're going to add to it, you know, and perhaps double or triple it. Okay, so we've got a lot of flexibility, you know, given ZTF. So there's the ZTF camera. Okay, 47 square degree field of view, you know, the venerable Palomar Sky Survey, their plates are just about, can just about be put a little bit inside the CCD array. Okay, as far as survey modes, so there's a nightly galactic plane scan from April through January. So we cover the galactic plane every night, or the visible galactic plane in the north and GNR. There's a high cadence of galactic observations. Those are undertaken by a combination of Caltech and the partnership. A much smaller area, about 1,000 square degrees, but essentially what we do is we take one field and just hammer on it continuously for the whole night. Okay. So amongst some of the things that my group is interested in are ultra-compact binaries with very short time periods. You'll be seeing coming out in Nature, it's been approved, accepted, etc., an observation of a 7-minute eclipsing double white dwarf binary where we've seen gravitational wave decay of the orbit at a few hundred sigma level. So we'll be seeing that in the next maybe week or two out of Nature. Okay, there's Northern Sky, which is the NSF-funded survey. It's the whole sky in GNR and essentially once every 3 days. And then there's a high declination survey, which is the partnership, which is 4 to 6 times a night in GNR. And then in addition to this, there's a little bit of I-band coverage also. And so as of sort of last year, here are the maps in R and G, and you can see this is a high declination. It's fairly well sampled because of this 4 to 6 times per night. Here's the galactic plane, also more sampled than the rest of it, and then the rest of the sky is done, the whole sky is done, Northern Sky Survey once about every 3 days. Okay, Just a couple more things. You probably know that ZTEP is putting out a few hundred thousand of alerts per night of everything in the sky, the northern sky that we observe that varies by more than 5 sigma. And we just did our first data release of photometric data last week. Okay. So questions about ZTEP? I think that's the quick ZTEP.
Can you say something about the bright limit and the faint limit of the...
Yeah, okay. So as it is done, almost all the observations are 30-second integration. And so the bright, the limiting magnitude that we quote is 20.5. Yeah, there are some variations on there depending if you're an RNG. And that's median. So sometimes we go down 21, okay, but sometimes, you know, like this winter, you know, hardly ever got down to 21. Mostly we're sitting around in clouds. So the median, though, is 20.5. And then we saturate around 12th magnitude. Okay. Yeah. Good question. Yeah?
Can you comment on, like, the data products and the availability, what time they come out for all these different sub-surveys? Because, you know, some of it's public, some of it's private.
Right.
It's a little confusing.
Yeah, so so this comes out, you know, essentially, you know, as soon as it's actually there, you know, the difference image is generated and the 5 sigma variation is found. Okay, that's a continuous stream. This is photometric data, okay, that covers.
That's catalogs.
What's that?
Is that catalogs or images or both?
It's both. Okay, you know, think of it as mostly light curves, so that's been our concentration. And that covers the nightly galactic plane, okay, for last summer, basically. That was the main extent of interest. And then this, and then the northern sky survey. Okay. And, you know, we're getting our feet on the ground as far as data releases. So right now, the data release for this guy is 1Z. You know, the interface is such that it can do 1Zs and 2Zs. Probably within 2 weeks, you'll see appearance of tarballs, which have the entire this entire data set that people can just download in mass and start working on. Okay. The partnership and the Caltech data are not public. Okay, they will be at some point, probably in, there will be a start on that in DR2, which will be the end of next December. Okay.
What's your total survey efficiency at 30-second exposures?
You mean as far as?
SLU settle plus readout.
Pardon me?
SLU and settle plus readout.
Yeah, okay, SLU and settle plus readout is 9 seconds.
All together?
Okay. Yes, yeah, yeah, everything
and
together.
So you SLU and settle while you read out?
Yep, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
When you say that time's going to come out of the public survey, which part of the public survey?
Both parts. This one and this one. I don't say what's public here. But public is the nightly galactic plane survey and the northern sky
survey.
Yeah,
but if you're going to take time out of the public survey to do tests, which parts would it come out?
That's still being discussed. Okay, so that's one of our variables, and that'll be decided within the project, and the project then is, you know, all of this. Okay, so we haven't exactly decided on that. There's a debate on whether or not you're an extragalactic transient person or you're a stellar galactic plane person, and we haven't decided yet. And in fact, probably what will happen is some will come out of each of those surveys. Yeah.
Yeah, you said you saturate at 12th magnitude, and that'll come down a bit as you go to shorter exposures.
Right.
But do you, and can you get light curves from stars brighter than your saturation? Do you try?
We haven't tried a lot, and the answer is yes, but we haven't pushed that. Okay, because there's so much interesting stuff, you know, and we're working, all the objects I'm interested in, maybe there's an 18th magnitude in there, but everything's 19th, 20th, that kind of thing. So we haven't pushed that. Okay, so all we know is we saturate there. We know that certainly there's going to start being problems. How far below that we could actually go? Even 12th takes some correction. But when I asked around, it said 12th. Yeah, you can do 12th.
And the alerts is, that's a 5 sigma difference from some running median?
Correct, yeah. So there are reference images taken. Okay, when we get roughly 15 reference images, sometimes less, sometimes a little bit more, of a given field of the sky, we calculate then a median. Those reference images have to be taken in good seeing, et cetera, et cetera. So once we have that, then we can do the difference.
Do the alerts go either way?
Yes, indeed. Yep.
One more minor question is precision. In other words, if you think about variability, you'd like to be able to know what the rough kind of differential photometry precision.
Right. Roughly, we hit a floor, I guess you'd call it, at about 10 millimags. Okay. And then, of course, statistics then towards our seeing limit get worse. And I'll have one specific point on that later.
So you're going to show sensitivity as a function of magnitude later?
No, I won't have that plot. I can get that plot if people are kind of interested in that.
Okay.
I mean, I'll show the test plot of that, but not necessarily the ZTF plot. ZTF plot, you can find it. There are a number of papers. I think that particular one is a paper by Maskey et al., which gives them the photometric performance of ZTF. Yeah?
Any other colors than G and big R?
Well, I.
That's okay. What I'm asking.
Yes. So, I, to date, has been a partnership observations. Okay, some of the partners have been very interested in I, and the partnership bought the I filter. But that's active discussion. We think that TESS is important enough that if I were important for TESS, we wouldn't make it happen.
So it just wasn't there, that's why I was asking.
Yeah. This is just standard. In fact, eye coverage is not nearly as complete because many fewer eye band measurements. But I think there's a public web page that shows things like this as far as what the public data is. And I think that may have eye band on it. It may not. So.
Just for clarification, is that little I Sloan or big
I? It's little I. Yeah. Yeah.
You can tell
from
the way I said it.
Yeah. Okay, so we can ask more questions about ZTF later. Just to introduce things, so this I stole from Thomas Barclay's talk. So these are the proposed targets for cycle two. And so these are the 2-minute sampling targets for cycle two. And you can see Kepler's up there. I think that may be something important up here. I don't know. Somebody might know.
But somebody should know. They probably proposed for it.
What's that?
I mean, this room probably proposed for it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, it says, okay, well, there, those are specific targets, but what I have been concentrating on and my group has been concentrating on is much more the 30-minute cadence data, okay, the full field 30-minute cadences. So talk a little bit about CTF complementarity. I just put this together this morning. ZTF has one arc second pixels, depending on the scene, two arc seconds in the winter. It's either better than 2 arcseconds, or it's totally abysmal. A TESS, 21 arcsecond pixels, and that's 50% energy containment within the 21 arcseconds. So I think that's the where I think that ZTF may be able to contribute to TESS best. Okay, is especially in anything even closely resembling a crowded field. And I would include, say, Kepler in that. It's really nice to have 20 squared, more resolution. And that's why I think I was surprised to see the exoplanet people very interested in this, because what they can do is see, is there anything else going on in that field of view that could be confusing. Okay, so CTF, we just talked about that, two or three colors, GR and I. TESS is one color, 600 to 1,000 nanometers. Already talked about this. ZTF Fleming magnitude 20.5, 30 seconds, 5 sigma median. This limit is about 19. I think that might be 5 sigma. Maybe it's actually even better than that, but I didn't have time to really go into that. For 12 seconds, that's what we proposed in the NASA proposal, 19.6 limiting median magnitude. This is the same. There was a question about precision. So one of the things we talked about or we thought about for the NASA proposal was to try to get actually some something similar at the faint end as far as precision. And so at 18th, ZTF is 40 millimags, 1 sigma. We'll see a plot in a second, and TESS is 70 millimags. So we tried to actually at the faint end try to get the precision somewhat complementary. Okay? So let me just back that up a bit with some other things. So there's a TESS response right out of the TESS Observatory Guide. This is a ZTF response. Yeah, why would you pick these colors? But anyway, so this is G, R, and I, basically. TESS, you can see roughly 600 to about 1,000 nanometers. Then this is the TESS photometric precision as a function of essentially apparent magnitude. I got this out. I should have probably gotten the ZTF one out of the Maske et al. Paper, but that's the one certainly. This is the plot that we have been using, or we used in our NASA proposal for just scoping out, you know, complementarity with our tests. So that's it. Those are all the slides I have, and now it's your turn. Okay. So here are some observation choices that we will have to be making. You know, and it's less than 2 months away, and actually probably a month before TESS goes into the Northern Hemisphere, we'll probably be doing the first Northern Hemisphere sector of TESS just as a trial run. Because, you know, things always go wrong when you try things for the first time, so we'll almost certainly do this. So one of the questions, a choice, should we cover the entire TESS footprint uniformly, or should we say, take a smaller, say, two of the TESS 24 by 24 fields of view and cover those more frequently? That's a question. Should we be doing more frequent coverage of crowded fields? Suggestions I've heard are, for instance, Kepler, galactic plane, plus or minus 10 degrees. So being a stellar guy, I'm especially interested sort of in that possibility. Yeah. Say 2 times 15-second integrations versus single 30-second integrations. And Tim, just before the start of this, said, okay, why don't you do a 1-second integration and then follow that with a 30-second integration? Thereby, you really get down to the very low end of the magnitude scale. And and then you still maintain a 30-second integration, which is the ZTF standard. The extragalactic transient folks would love this suggestion, because it maintains their 30-second time. And then the other question kind of worth thinking about is I-band coverage in addition to GNR. The NASA proposal had just GNR, but especially now that we have additional time potentially available, we could, for instance, mix and match the Caltech and the MSIP time, and also do IBAN. Okay, so that's it, but you guys may think of other things we can do. Yeah, you look like you're ready to go.
Sure. So one thing that occurs to me about this is a distinction between using ZCAM for things that are periodic and that are not.
Yep.
If you're going after things that are really periodic, then I don't think you care about simultaneity with tests as long as you have the ephemerides from tests.
Oh, that's correct, yeah.
And so then that would push you toward covering more area, but not getting it at the same time as tests,
yeah,
and just kind of scattering across the sky.
Yeah.
Also, another thing to think about is that Gaia has excellent photometry over the whole sky now. I think it goes at least as well in crowded regions as ZPF, right, given the PSF size. The variability information isn't particularly good yet, but it will improve. But right now, you have three color information, G, B, and R, and mean magnitudes that are good to very, very high precision.
Yep.
So to what extent, so the kinds of things I'm wondering, to what extent do we care about simultaneity versus not? To what extent do we want to sacrifice the additional colors for more observations all over the place? Partly, to me, that's a question of whether we're going after purely periodic signals or transients that are not.
Yeah, so one thing, it's very clear, you know, my first question was, how can ZTF help?
Yeah.
ZTF does all kinds of science. We don't claim to be able to do everything by any means. So you're absolutely right. So static sources, you know, you don't have to do multicolor static sources because there's PanSTARRS, there's Gaia, you know, that you don't have to do. So in my opinion, if we do color photometry, it's because of sources that vary.
Yeah.
Okay, that may be on this month, but weren't on 2 months before.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
What about doing a field every day?
Pardon me?
What about doing a test field every day?
Okay,
I mean, is that what you're planning on doing? That's what I've heard rumors.
That was the baseline. The baseline was do tests in GNR every day.
Okay.
But we have, because that we want to do that with Caltech time, okay, and it was and I did and I proposed it that way because I could deliver that, okay, without any other, you know, machinery required. Okay, so that's the baseline. Cover the test field every day in GNR. But what this discussion about is, should we be doing different things? Should we be adding eyes?
Well, I thought you were saying just do it once. I didn't know you were talking about doing it.
No, but Andy, maybe you should speak to the value of that before it goes away.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you have to find the supernovae. For supernovae, you have to find them.
Right.
And so you do follow-up information.
Right.
You get other follow-up resources. And so, every day is really the only thing to do.
Yeah.
At
and,
least.
And by the way,
that's important to say out loud. Yeah, for the audience.
Yeah, I think that's important. Also, now I'll channel an extragalactic transient person, which is difficult for me.
You don't need to. They're in the room.
But remember what's happening here. The 30-minute data, okay, comes out 2 months, you know, later, right? So what ZTF can do is say, okay, there was a supernova there, right? Okay, that day, that night. And then people then can know that there's 30-minute data coming, continuous sampling, and they can start, you know, doing follow-up observations based on that expectation.
Yes, to clarify, you're saying the 30-minute data from tests will come out later, but you have to find it first.
Right, you have to find it first,
yes.
Do the quick observations, do the classification, all those kinds of things. Yeah.
So I wanted to say something about the value of having simultaneous coverage, because there's something really exciting about having the G-band simultaneous to the test data, especially from the cool stars and exoplanet point of view, because there are some things that are super interesting. For example, star spot contrast is low in the test bed. It's been designed that way. But if you have simultaneous G-band, then you can see the amplitude of the stellar rotational variability and can, for example, estimate star spot temperatures from that, at least in a statistical manner. Also from the exoplanet point of view, there's exciting stuff probably going on with secondary eclipses of exoplanets, where we expect to see possibly time variability at the shorter, bluer wavelengths.
Yep.
So simultaneous tests, planetary eclipses, and G-band would be a fantastic thing to have.
Right. I think, by the way, thank you. I think that's a very, very good. I just wrote it down. The one thing is, you know, we are covering the tests footprint continuously. We, at any given time, we're only 47 square degrees. Okay. So to catch an eclipse or a transit or something like that is probably unlikely. But I think as far as getting though something that's varying continuously and getting simultaneous and be able to pin the G-band, point well taken.
I think one of the issues that we face here is that one of the weaknesses of the TESS approach from a variability point of view is the short dwell time. And so there is actually a really good science argument for having longer baseline observations for at least a portion of this.
Yeah.
Because, for example, if you have an eclipse, you'd like to catch a second one. If you'd like to have a period that's marginal to detect at the 27-day window, you'd like to have longer than that.
Yeah.
And so, of course, it doesn't have to be everything. You know, that science doesn't have to be everything, but that really should be some, because if you're really trying to complement tests, that's going to be a place where it's valuable. Also, from the point of view of crowding, sort of the right end of your range is going to be the range where tests can actually do variability studies well. There's a nice cross-matching. I'm a bit concerned here that with kind of 1% level of precision, some of the tests you're talking about may be tough to pull off in practice.
What?
Most people get more active.
Yeah, that would be
brighter,
more
interesting. In fact, if anyone can tell me why we are at all, can contribute at all to astrophysiology or geochronology, let me know, because I haven't seen the killer argument for that yet with CTF, and you wouldn't expect to. So. Yeah. By the way, let me say one thing, though, is that, as far as long-term coverage, I think TESS is in a good position because certainly CTF can do that, but Atlas can do it, Assassin can do it. Okay, so it is going to be very good, right? Because we have a lot of large area sky surveys that are going to give long-term contextual information here. If CTF can do anything specific there, bring it up. Right.
Yeah, just following from Mark's point, that's all you're putting
a bank. It doesn't matter.
extending the baseline is quite a good idea, because even if you're not, if you're doing, for example, astroseismology on a star, you often want to know its rotation period, which could be longer than 27 days.
Right.
So you might want to think about trading off the North Ecliptic Pole, which TESS has covered all the time, with broadening around the lower latitude. So in other words, observing before and after TESS and making their 27 days into the 50 or something.
Yep.
And not worrying so much because the North Ecliptic Pole is
a pretty small area.
But I guess what I'm saying is you're not constrained to have the same pointings as TESS does. TESS is, for a reason, the solar panels and all that has this strange pattern.
For the purpose of this discussion, please think, they can point anywhere.
Yeah.
In fact, there was a little bit of a hole right at the north pole, not the ecliptic pole, but the north pole that we couldn't cover because of ancient constraints on, that's fixed now, so we can cover anywhere. Let's see, why don't we go to Ryan, he has his hand up next.
I just wanted to point out that in addition to the poles and everything, you should really think about having a variety of observations for different parts of the sky. You know, different RAs have different amounts of the galactic plane that is up in the north, and so that's just going to be a different thing than other regions. When the Kepler field is being viewed by TESS, then maybe you want to just hit the Kepler field as long as it's up and forget about the rest of that that slice. From the extragalactic point of view, when Virgo's up, wouldn't it be great if you did that for four times a night or something, because there's typically one or two Virgo supernovae every year. Those are going to be way more valuable than the things that are barely detected by Kepler. There's just a variety of different things like that I think, you know, you could think of. And then for my, you know, when I was thinking about this a little bit more from my extragalactic perspective, I was thinking maybe, you know, since Kepler has already, or TESS has already discovered something like 20 or so supernovae, that's a lot more than maybe we can follow. So instead of doing nightly observations where you say, all right, then you know within a night, maybe you say you take four observations every four nights or three observations every three nights, something like that, over a four-hour period, if you're willing to go to high air mass, and just realize that you're only going to get that dense coverage for a third of the objects that TESS is going to have data on.
Okay.
But the TESS, it's not true that there are too many supernovae to follow in the TESS fields. It's true for all of ZTF. But within TESS, for things that are actually bright enough to get good data out of TESS, there's very few.
It's been about 20 so far.
Not great. Of really great objects, there's only a few, because you really have to go five magnitudes down from the peak be interesting. Only about 18 is really useful. So you're talking about maybe 19. So you're talking about things that peak at like 14 or something. So there's very few.
So if you really, I think it's actually much better than that. But if you really only want to get things that are like 13th or 14th, then you have to be looking at galaxies within 20 megaparsecs. And at that point, you might as well be very targeted.
Lars, you have something to say?
No, I just always find it entertaining how we can have 15 cell astronomers who agree and two.
I know.
So we roughly agree. That's just a question of.
Okay, so let me take control again. Rachel, I'll get back to you and Tim. Yeah, I'll get back to Rachel and Tim, but I want to follow up the one thing, because Jim and I were discussing it. Is it valuable for us to cover the Kepler field better or more often, or is that just not of interest? And remember, TESS has 21 arcsecond pixels with 50% energy containment. So if there's anything else going on within that 21 arcseconds, and Kepler, we know, is not a pristine high latitude region, is that valuable?
Well, I mean, there's imaging of the Kepler field already that made the Kepler look
Anything that's constant, you know, that's not of interest. What's of interest here is anything that might be varying. So, and that's, for instance, what Andrew Howard was most interested in, is are there other things that are in the field where he's trying to do his exoplanet work? And are they turning on and varying at the time he wants to look at? So I'll take that's a no vote, okay.
I'm going to give what I thought would be the heretical response, but maybe not, that no, it's not valuable.
Okay.
The precision for TESS is so much worse. It's 1% the collecting area of Kepler. The pixels are so much bigger. TESS is going to give very weak information for most of the things in Kepler. Most Kepler objects are faint. And so it's a minority of targets that TESS is going to give interesting things that we will learn about Kepler field objects for, and they're the fields that you're saturating on, the stars you're saturating on.
Thank you, because that was actually my guess. When I saw that plot that said, okay, we're going to cover the Kepler field, et cetera, et cetera, I said,
I think there's an argument to cover the Kepler field, but I don't think it should be, I don't think it needs to be simultaneous.
What's that?
It doesn't have to be simultaneous with TESS.
If it was every night for 4 or 5 months, with fairly short exposures, I think there's value to that. The value added from having it when TESS is looking at it, I think, is very small.
As Thomas knows, do you want to say something about the TESS fields we observed in continuous cadence, the CTF?
Between?
Yeah.
We did Kepler fields.
We did selected parts of the Kepler field.
Exactly, sorry, yes, Kepler field.
Oh, I said TESS, no, Kepler. Yeah. Yes. So why don't you say something about
K2
that?
Or
Kepler, the original Kepler field.
Yeah, but not the whole thing. Right.
Well, no, we selected a few fields which are covering part of the Kepler field, and right, we did that with continuously for 2 hours, or 2 or 3 nights, something like this.
So for Kepler, we at least have some data, which is a very highly sampled, and can do variability very well on sort of everything from a minute up to an hour. Rachel, sorry.
I was going to touch on something I think we somewhat discussed in that last segment of discussion, is that if you were doing simultaneous observations with the test in crowded fields, then you have multicolor photometry, a better chance of disentangling some of the irregular variability that would two tests be in a single pixel with something you actually care about, for example. But we somewhat discussed that.
Yep, thank you, Rachel. Yeah, Tim, I think you're next in line. Or maybe, who knows? Yeah, so.
A quick comment, since a few people mentioned longer baselines, is that TESS's orbit is apparently very stable. It can stay up there forever. And they are already planning for a mission extension. That mission extension will be, I believe, 2 years to basically cover the same fields. So you will have some issues with the window function, but it means you will effectively have 1.5 to 2 year baselines. And so that will cover a lot of the long-term variability. If something is at the edge of your observing window, you'll get another chance and you'll be able to get those longer period systems. So I think that alleviates some of the pressure to do that with
CPF. Yeah. By the way, let me just ask a question, and maybe it's these two guys, anybody else that was at Sci-Log. Thomas Berkeley discussed the mission extension. And one interesting thing I pulled out of one of his plots is that right after the first year of Northern Sky survey, there's another 4 months of Northern Sky.
Isn't that
great? Yeah, so the nominal mission in between.
Okay, so that's to do the ecliptic. There was no indication of that, but that was to do the ecliptic in the northern sky for those 4 months. Got it. Okay. Yeah, so I think we...
So I just want to advocate for the color information. There's a whole variety of transient phenomena associated particularly with cool stars, and these can be things going up or things going down, but they occur... episodically and sporadically. These include things like flaring, of course, but also we see circumstellar dust that's occluding the star, or something that's occluding the star. And in order to actually discriminate between the physical explanations for these things, color is important, but also to remove the possibility of systematics, because white light from TESS does not necessarily solve that problem. Okay. So having a G and an I, for example, would be a powerful way to...
So your vote is G and I.
Hmm? Can I ask a question on this? We talked a lot about these additional variability. What would be the cadence? Like, would be a one-night cadence enough? Would preferably be like...
If I had a menu there, I would say 2 times a night would be sort of my minimum.
For filter. Oh.
For a pointing. To revisit the pointing twice a night.
In each color,
please. Can I have 5?
We're also taking votes for favorite.
Phenomena are typically sort of hours to many days, so that's kind of.
And also, we're always looking for funding. So if you have a special 47 square degree field of view and you're willing to help us, so let's talk.
Can I ask a question? How fast can the observing configuration be reconfigured?
Good question. Eric Baum at the University of Washington does the scheduling, and it's a matter of him going in there and building enough flexibility into the scheduler to do that. So for targets of opportunity, we can react essentially instantaneously. To do large-scale changes in the scheduling, much more difficult.
Because there is a internal discussion of the, in the test team of a possibility of a test alert that would be something that ZTF could follow.
Yeah. So definitely, we've built TOO capability into ZTF, and we use it in many different instances. So you can imagine EMGW, the latest LIGO Virgo. Candidates, lots of TOOs for that. We do TOOs on asteroids. We do lots of different things. Yeah. So TOOs, yes, definitely.
Just as a more general comment, and going to what I think Ben mentioned as well, is that most of the really exciting science from stellar astrophysics and exoplanets from TESS will come out of the brightest stars. So for the astroseismology, we expect something like 12th and brighter. That's where most of the exciting science will be. So I think pushing, in some ways, the bright limit of CTF as bright as possible will maximize the science that would come out. For example, you know, measuring location periods of stars where we can do astroseismology. Won't be too many, but this will be valued by other things within 12 magnitude. So I realize that this is obviously in opposite directions of what the extragalactic science would be aiming for, so I'm not sure what, how you can compare those.
Soft times, right? The short, long exposure thing, right?
Right, but is the bright limit, what is, so you mentioned 12 magnitude before, is that?
That was 30 seconds.
Yeah, so 12th magnitude for 30 seconds. Observations, 11th magnitude. But I have a question myself that, so why shouldn't Assassin just do the bright end, okay? And CTF then concentrates somewhere it's best, which is more the fainter end. So anybody have comments?
Assassin pixels are bigger.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Yeah, there are 8-second pixels, 15-second.
The right side. No, but if you, for example, want to do, so this is going to, lead into my question was your primary star may be saturated. So one interesting question is basically how well you can work close to the bright stars and recover signals there, because we would like to also identify stars which are varying, which are interfering, providing contaminating signals to the bright star.
Yeah. So I don't have a number on that.
Care to do the bright star.
Right now, that's an active area of investigation in CTF, because obviously we want to also get closer and closer to those bright stars. So we are working on methods for subtracting out the diffraction spikes, et cetera, from bright stars. Yeah. So, but I can't give you a number. Don't have it up here.
So if Assassin did cover it, could you coordinate between ZTF and Assassin so that you were observing at different ends of the night or something and swapping, or so that you the field is covered two times a night for certain?
Absolutely. Yeah, we can do that. By the way, that's another thing I didn't list, is that, but we have been thinking about, is that, you know, TESS was at opposition, right? So what should our strategy be? Because we're going to be trying to observe the whole night. So do we observe the leading edge, in some sense, of the test field first? So, you know, as the night gets later, then we observe what might be called the trailing edge. So we've had those discussions. So, you know, I'll be glad to discuss that with them.
Go ahead.
How sure are you of that 10 millimag floor? Is there any hope of getting a little bit lower than that? Better than that?
Probably not. 10 millimags, so 10 millimags is doable for a good portion of the data now. That's absolute. Okay, relative photometry may be able to push down a little bit more, but that's a current area of technical investigation with CTF. So don't hold your breath as a 10 millimax.
In that context, when you shorten the exposure times, do you have an idea about the noise floor then, when you get atmospheric turbulence influencing the photometry?
Yeah, so the 10 millimax is pretty much dominated by systematics, okay? It's not statistics anymore. Okay, so we're going to probably hit that if we go down the shorter exposure time.
1 second.
That takes a detailed, though, investigation, and we have not done that yet. So, but it's basically, you know, statistics, sky background, and then a floor of just systematics, of CCD systematics. These are huge. Our big problem is there's a huge, you know, set of detectors, and it's the calibration across individual CCDs and individual quadrants that is dominating right now our systematics for photometry.
In terms of where the time would come from, did you say it would come from the public time, but be decided by the private collaboration?
It would be decided by the project. So the project includes all of Caltech, it includes the public time, and it includes the partnership.
Public time has very little, the public has very little input into actually what ZTF is doing or can doing. There's this like committee, but it's a Mickey Mouse committee. It doesn't really do anything.
Should I? I will not quote that. That committee has already been consulted and has weighed in and likes the idea of going after tests. So.
But if they're
Mickey Mouse.
I know people on the committee who feel that way. But the question is, are you going to take it out of the plane or out of the plane survey? Is anybody ever actually used the plane survey for like nightly cadence to actually do nightly photometry type things from that? I mean, do people publish papers on this? Yes, I do. That's a serious question.
Oh, now we got, instead of two extragalactic types, we actually sell it. That's even worse. That's much worse.
It's a serious question on, are there things that once you've done, like, say, variables that you may need a data cadence for. Once you know them, and it's not like a supernova or something that comes and goes and it's gone, right? So like there's a certain argument to be said for you do it for a period of time, which has been done. Okay, now you know like interesting stuff there. Then why do you need to keep?
That's not true of microlensing, Andy.
That's true, but are people really doing ZTF microlensing?
Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm.
It's the office next door, dude.
But I mean, where is it?
Andy, any other questions for Tom?
No, but this is a serious question.
Yeah. What's that? Andy?
Okay, and I'm here all day.
Tom gave this talk to us, the public.
So. Yeah, but what else?
Yeah.
So I was going to ask if you have any plans what to do when Tesla starts pointing south again. Because, for example, one thing you might do is look at the North Ecliptic Pole while Tesla's not looking at it and try and bridge the year gap for the sort of rotating slow variables, etc. So when Tesla does point north again, you can then stop.
Yep. So as you can imagine, we haven't gone anywhere near that yet. We're just trying to get things. By the way, there's a collaboration right with partners and all kinds of people. So just getting that battleship, sort of pointing in a different direction in the next 2 months is challenge enough right now. So
And I think on this theme of multiple programs, one of the things to stress is there are very long time scale sources of stellar variability. We're having a very long stream of like 1% data could be super interesting. A good example is in the case of microlensing is one. Another good example would be in the case of astroseismology of luminous giants, where the amplitudes are actually quite high. The periods are extremely long. And having very long dwell times could be super interesting. That might even be an interesting synergy with extragalactic, because you might be able to think of red supergiant oscillation.
Good point. Let me make a comment. I showed you this high declination. Are you more interested in the plane or?
For the astroseismology, probably the plane. Yep. If you want to try doing things extragalactic, I like to.
By the way, the high declination field, if you're not interested in the plane specifically, will eventually become public and will be a very interesting data set. So the 7-minute binary, the first data come out of ZTF that we got was from the high declination field, not from the galactic plane, and that's where we got the 7-minute binary. So that's a very interesting data set. So let's see. I'm going to see if there are other people that, and I haven't been scanning this part of the audience today. Okay, Ryan.
I'll ask you again about the I-band and what other people think about this, because in the public data release so far, you've put out GNR.
Yeah.
And if we just exclude tests in general, just having that I-band data, if it were publicly released, would be completely novel and unique. And I know, I personally would also really like GRI light curves. Yeah. So I'm just curious if the stellar community has a view of the I-band, maybe with tests, maybe without.
The value of I-band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if we could get 3-band photometry, you know, I would like that. And I would also just generically want to know what's going on in the I band across the whole sky for anything that's variable, which we don't have currently in the public data.
So in synergy with TESS, of course, TESS has a redder bandpass in the first place.
So is that good or bad?
On the other hand, G and I would give you better color handles on those stars.
Well, TESS is I.
Yeah, but if, yeah, once you know G and R, you know I from TESS, effectively. I mean, it,
except for high extinction fields, not necessarily.
But I mean, I don't think it's actually that useful because it decreases the frequency with which you can come back, and you really want to find things really young. And it's far more cheap to go and do pointed I-band follow-up once you know the things are there than doing the whole field over and over, unless you need it for stellar things that, you know, where you need a ton of it all the time, and you can't do pointed. But for most cases, you can do pointed I-band follow-up.
So I'll say something here. Maybe I shouldn't say it because it reveals a little bit of insight into the partnership. Is that I'm predicting that the partnership will love I-band observations because right now the I-band observations are limited by the number of reference images there are. Is it just this little bit of extra stuff? So if I-band images were taken over the TESS field over 13 months, the I-band people would have all the references they want.
So the public can provide the G-band and the private partnership can provide the I-band?
You're starting to see some of my thinking to get even more time on this. Okay, so. Yeah, but again, you know, the object is not to get tons of time. The object is to say, are there things that ZTF can do that are useful for the community? Okay. So, and don't take away from the other NSF or partnership items. So.
All right. I think we're going to stop and thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And Tom is here. So
I've written down a lot of stuff here, so thank you.